meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. If you are a regular listener to the program or happen to pick it up on the archives by going to ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, you'll remember me interviewing the author of a book called No Room for Doubt, the true story of the reverberations of murder. The impact of one violent moment can change lives forever. Debbie Whitlock's mysterious murder profoundly altered the lives of those closest to her and the case. This is their story told by the last person to see Debbie alive. And for those of you watching on Channel 7, I'll hold the book up. Go to Amazon.com and check it out. Again, it's called No Room for Doubt. Now, Debbie Whitlock's mom is Jackie McDonald. Now, I happen to have her on along with Angela Dove in May, I believe it was. Again, you can go onto the webpage and pick up the show if you want. Just run Angela Dove or No Room for Doubt or Jackie McDonald, and you can pick up the old show from May. But I sat down with Jackie McDonald this afternoon to talk about this, where the case is. I always like to talk to victims, parents of victims of murder, missing persons, and see how they're doing. And there's something called Debbie's Law that's being worked on. And for those of you that are a little squeamish, I will caution you now that the story of the death of Debbie Whitlock is quite horrific. And what we're talking about when it comes to Debbie's Law is something that is mind-boggling, to say the least. So again, I sat down with Jackie McDonald this afternoon to get an update as far as Debbie's Law and to see what's going on with the case. And here's Jackie McDonald, who, by the way, hosts her own talk show, Victim's Voice is what it's called. And you can click on the link in the show notes to learn more information about times and places that you can hear that talk show by Jackie McDonald. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio, and of course, I'm Dana Pretzer. Back in May, we had Angela Dove and Jackie McDonald on to talk about the book No Room for Doubt. And I want to share this with you. It's right on the front cover of the book. The impact of one violent moment can change lives forever. Debbie Whitlock's mysterious murder profoundly altered the lives of those closest to her and the case. This is their story, told by the last person to see Debbie alive. And the book, again, No Room for Doubt. And Debbie Whitlock's mom, Jackie McDonald, joins me. And if you click on the link in the show notes, you'll see Jackie is a talk show host herself. A Victim's Voice is the show, remembering victims, supporting their survivors. And I love that that saying on her webpage. Just click on the link in the notes. Hi, Jackie. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. And for those that don't remember, and again, any of you want to go to the webpage at scaredmonkeysradio.com, just put in Jackie's name and you'll be able to bring up the show from May and listen to it. For those who don't remember, and I'm sure you, every time you're asked to retell the story, it probably gets to you a little bit, obviously, because you're Debbie's mom. I want you to share with my audience a little bit about Debbie and her death.
And can I please say before I start that every program I've been on, I've always said, please, the only thing I care about is that people know that Debbie was the hero.
Yeah.
Because her daughter did not wake up.
Absolutely.
We got the phone call March 25, 1988, and, you know, your life goes from wonderful to disaster in 1 minute. My son-in-law, who was a deputy sheriff at the time, had called my husband's boss for him to and said that Dennis should call his boss. Dennis was on his way back to Minnesota with his mother, who was visiting from California the first time. So Anyway, what happened was that I told Dennis when he got home, please go phone Cliff and find out what's wrong. And what happened was he walked into the family room and he looked strange. And I said, what's the matter? And he said, Cliff called. And I said, oh my God, Karen. And he said, no, Debbie, sit down. And I said, I'm not. And he said, I said, what's wrong? I thought maybe Debbie had been in a car accident because she had to drive to work.
Right.
And he said, Debbie's dead. And he swears he didn't say this, but this is what I heard. He said, somebody cut her throat.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately went into shock. And he found me walking up and down the street outside. And I don't remember very much. I remember feeling his hands on my shoulders. And then, of course, he called my minister. And I didn't know in the beginning all the details, but what I did know was that somebody had broken into Debbie's house. Her husband was at a bachelor party. Her three-year-old daughter was asleep, and that they had murdered her.
And like you say, Jackie, at the start, the little three-year-old slept nearby, and thank God for that.
She was in the next bedroom.
Right.
And the strange thing is that normally, like most kids, Courtney would get up at 2 in the morning and go and climb in bed with her parents. And that night, she didn't wake up.
Mm-hmm.
She slept. And then, of course, Debbie's husband found her. When he got home, called the police, and he was taken to the police station. And they interrogated him. They vacuumed him. He was a suspect.
Right. And it was a journey that most should never have to go through, from March 25th, 1988 until 1996 for you and your family. Tell us a little bit about that journey. Of course, it's outlined in the book, but you didn't give up.
Actually, it was 97, excuse me. But what happened was we had, Dennis is my second husband, and we had just bought a little house in Minnesota, and he let me put the house on the market immediately and told me that I needed to be home near my daughter and my surviving daughter. And a year later, we came back to California. But 1 week after the funeral, when I got back to Minnesota, I started calling televisions. I call Unsolved Mysteries, and I called them for 6 years, and I got on. America's Most Wanted only took 4 years, and I hired a psychic, Noreen Rainier, that I had seen on 48 Hours. And then I started calling every small channel that had a little talk show. And I did this for 9 years. And then one day I was watching television, and there was an ordinary person with a little talk show. And I thought, I could do that. And that's how we started The Victim's Voice. And we've been on the local cable for 14 years, excuse me, since 96.
It's been
cool. And I thought, why can't I do radio? And that evolved. KYOS in Merced has let me be on radio for 12 years.
And when I shared this with the audience at the start of the interview, remembering victims supporting their survivors, what does that mean to you?
Well, we all have to help each other. Every time I got a chance to be on a talk show, I would plug my friends to see if I could get them on with me, especially Janelle Riley, whose daughter was murdered on campus in Orange County. And it's amazing. I sort of built up a network of people. And if I could please say, you know, I'm saying I. This was not something I did alone.
Mm-hmm.
I had these wonderful people that were helping me. And I had a husband, a second husband, who supported me every part of the way. One time I thought, why can't I have a billboard on the freeway? And so I tried to get a billboard for almost 3 years with no luck. And there's a wonderful organization, and I hope you have them on. They're called Citizens Against Homicide.
Mm-hmm.
It's run by victims. It's non-profit. And I called them, and a lady called Jane Alexander, who has sadly since passed, and whose story has been on Hallmark, Citizen Jane, asked me what she could do to help me. She didn't ask for money. And I told her, she said, may we use our logo, and we will help you pay for it. And within 3 months, I had my billboard. And I'm very proud to say that I was their inspiration for the billboard, and I was their first success. And now they get billboards for everybody all over the country.
That's fantastic. Jackie McDonald is here. We're talking about the murder of her daughter and, of course, Jackie's show, The Victim's Voice. Let's talk a little bit about Scott Fizell. And I know he's probably a name you don't like to hear, but let's talk about him and let's talk about Debbie's Law.
Well, Debbie's Law, sadly, when I found out that my daughter had been raped post-mortem, I immediately called Dennis Cardoza, who is my friend, who is now our congressman, who was our assemblyman at that time, and he actually was very quick. He wrote up a law. We went to the legislature to make it either a crime punishable by death or life without parole, and we went to the legislature, and of course it failed because everybody saw death. Nobody saw life.
Right.
A couple of years later, Barbara Matthews, who took over, again took it to the legislature. It went to the Appropriations Committee, and then they dumped it. And now Kathleen Galgiani, who is now our assembly person because Barbara retired, she's going to take it back to see if we can do something next year.
And if you could, if we could just stick with this for a second, and I know it's difficult for you to discuss, what are we looking for when it comes to Debbie's Law, and how can the people help?
They can write to their Congress person if they're in California. I know there are some places where it is a law. And my friend Sherry Simpson, who you know, told me there's about nine places that it is a law, but it isn't one in California. Just write to your congressman. Tell them that you're outraged and that this needs to be a law. When this first happened, because I'm a former Brit, I called the embassy. And they said it wasn't a law in England.
Really?
But it is now. And I don't know about Canada.
Well, it is up here. But it is mind-boggling, though, is it not, to understand that some places that's not a law? Like, what kind of society are we living in today? Is it just a lack of understanding, Jackie, or how do you explain it?
Well, I've heard that this is what serial killers do, that they go back and reoffend their victims. What we were trying to do is, as I said, make it either death, because if you murder somebody deliberately, I mean, I know people don't believe in the death penalty, and actually I didn't care if he got death or life without parole, because I never wanted him to see a beach or the sunset again. I wanted him in prison forever. But of course he didn't get that. He got 6 for robbery, minus 2.5 served, and 25 to life. Which means in 2017 he's eligible for parole. And about the law, I don't know if we could get anything passed. We can certainly try and make the public aware of it, but you know, in California they're letting some people out because of money.
Yeah, it's money, it's overcrowding, it's all the sort of stuff, but when it comes down to the victim. And I'm trying not to be morose or awful. If the victim is alive or the victim is dead, once that victim is brutalized, they're still a victim. And this is just nuts, for lack of a better term. And please write your congressperson, whoever, if you live in a state, California especially, this needs to be looked after. 2017 seems like a long time from now, but it's not really. And this is something, again, that I'd like to talk to you a little bit about, because, you know, just looking in the book here, under Debbie's Law, Chapter 22, it says the defense's sentencing memorandum had labeled Fizell's crimes as a one-time bout of sexual rage. And that alone just throws up so many red flags that I want to get your comment on that.
Well, I personally don't think this could have been his first offense.
No.
When he did break in the house, he was high on methamphetamine, and he was 18 years old. And can I be crude on your program?
Absolutely.
Well, you know, people say, oh, he was high on meth, and my answer to that is, well, he knew how to undo a zipper.
Yeah.
You know, and he knew how to perform sexual acts. It wasn't just rape. And it's very difficult for me to say this, but it was also sodomy.
I understand. And it's 1988. Seems like a long time ago. It's not really.
Yesterday.
It's yesterday for the victims' families. It's and you live it over and over and over again. Jackie, and this is a very broad-based question, but the system. Let's talk about the system itself. Your family has gone through it. It took a long time and a lot of fighting from your family, yourself. I remember Angela telling me how strong and how hard you fought. And we see so many other stories. You cover them on your show, The Victim's Voice. And is the system, I think it's a pretty good system, but it does need a lot of fine-tuning. We're better than most civilized nations, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And I think one of the things is education, not only for the judges, but the DAs, the defense attorneys, and not so much running the system. And I'm talking about the penal system, the criminal system, as a business, trying to make money and the cost of things. It's protecting the citizens, I think, is being ignored because of the almighty dollar. Your thoughts. Am I wrong?
No, I agree with you. And, you know, as being in law enforcement, you certainly know that. No, I agree.
And it's heartbreaking, and I've been doing my job now for 28 years, and I've seen the system even in just in Canada change from a consequences system to a rehabilitative system, and at times there's nothing wrong with that, but without consequences, we're not doing anything to protect people and young people, especially the kids out there. There's a lot of predators, a lot running around, and if we can just say you've served your time, that's it, we're going to let you go, we're not going to look at the real story behind you and let somebody out of jail to go walk the streets and re-victimize again. And I don't like that term, but it's a very valid term. You know, what can we do, Jackie, from now the perspective of my show, your show, and the other shows that are out there, to try and educate the folks about the problems that are ongoing?
Well, I think you're doing, I don't think I know, you're doing a beautiful job, and all we can do is just keep it out there. And if I may also say, it wasn't just Debbie who was murdered.
Right.
Her husband died because he was accused. And I knew he didn't kill Debbie, but in the court of public opinion, he was guilty, even though the police exonerated him. And so Courtney not only lost her mother, she lost her father.
Yep.
And people have to think about that. There's so much sympathy for the poor criminal. But people have to think about what happens to the families afterwards.
Are we glorifying in the media? I think we are. That's in movies, television shows. There are shows like this awful Dexter that's out there. I actually have never watched it, but
I haven't.
I know a lot of people that have, and it just sickens me to see that the glorification of someone who's out committing crimes. If it isn't the Hollywood elite that seem to be hardly slapped on the wrist for their problems, and they're brought up as role models to the media and the movies and television shows. What's wrong with media today? Why is the public enthralled and infatuated with these lunatics?
I honestly don't know. Maybe it is because of the movies, and you know, because the movie starts playing bad people on screen, and people sort of get carried away and don't realize it's just a movie.
Well, you know, even and to see a television show, and I'm going to pick on Dexter a little bit, and the fascination with someone who goes out and kills people is beyond me. We just seem that justice has been thrown out the window. If you're just tuning in, Jackie McDonald's here, and again, I encourage you to all go out and pick up the book, No Room for Doubt. Angela Dove is the author, and it's the story of Jackie's daughter, Debbie Ann Whitlock, who was murdered in 1988, and the story thereafter. What's coming up for you, Jackie, and The Victim's Voice? let's get a plug in.
Oh, well, thank you. Actually, the college in Modesto, the professor is Carol Mingus Lancaster Mingus, and her students are now shooting our program. We've, since 96, I've had this little program, half-hour program, for victims of violent crime. And we have a police officer on, and we have a victim's family member, which to me is very important because I hate the word victim. Mm-hmm. People need to know that it's somebody who is loved and who is loved and is missed. It's somebody's child,
right.
Somebody's mother, father. And we must never forget that.
That is so important. And again, remembering victims, supporting their survivors is, I think, a catchphrase for anyone involved in what we do to try and get the story out there for those that can't get their stories heard. Again, the book, No Room for Doubt, Jackie McDonald. Give us one more update on Debbie's Law. What's going to happen here in the near future? Because I know you, and you're not going to give up on this.
Well, no, I'm not, but I've been trying to get, because they're going to have elections, I need to have a sit-down with Kathleen Galgiani and Robin, her aide, and then when I know what's happening, you're the first, I'll let you know.
Okay. That sounds great, because I want to help the best I can and get the word out and educate the folks, as we like to say. Joe and Mary Sixpack, as we call them, out there that listen to the program, wherever they pick it up, need to know what's going on. Because really, Jackie, when it comes down to this, and I'll give you the last word, a lot of people, you know, they mean well, but unless it affects them, it doesn't really interest them. They may pick up on it a little bit. They don't want to get involved unless it directly involves their family. There's that core group, and I know my audience is that are interested in these stories, but unless we can get the word out and change media somewhat, it's going to be a bit difficult to get everyone to understand, and that's why we try very hard at what we're doing. Jackie, I'll give you the last word.
Well, in people's defense, I think they're afraid.
Yeah.
You know, it's like sometimes when a person has a deadly disease, people are afraid to speak to them because they think it's catching.
Yeah.
This is not catching. And if I may quote a dear friend of mine, Mary Marcus, she's a nurse practitioner. When Debbie was murdered, she said to me, "Dreadful as it is, Jackie, you have two choices. You can live or you can die," which meant I can curl up on a couch and block the world out. And I have a husband who is my biggest supporter. And so when I got back to Minnesota, I started calling, and I called some programs for 6 years. And that's what you do. Make a list. Do something every day, even if it's like putting their flyers on a Pizza Hut takeout. Go to your pizza store. I did, and that's what they did for me. There's a bus system. There are shopping carts. There are so many things you can do that are expensive and that aren't expensive. And look Citizens Against Homicide up online, and they have a newsletter, which is wonderful, and you can write your story.
Absolutely. It sounds great. Jackie McDonald, I'll be in touch, in fact, in the next day or so.
Thank you, and I want to thank you, and you are such a blessing to people like myself.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. So much.
No problem. We'll talk soon, Jackie.
Okay.
Bye bye
now.
Bye bye. That's Jackie McDonald, and talking about the story of her daughter, Debbie Ann Whitlock, who was murdered tragically in 1988, and the fight for Debbie's Law. Again, the book is No Room for Doubt, the true story of the reverberations of murder. And it's by Angela Dove. By the book, it's a story that you won't soon forget. I'm Dana Fretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. And I just want to share with you, now we're back live, that Debbie's murderer, this Scott Fizell, will be eligible for parole in 2017. Now, you know as well as I do, eligible for parole and actually getting parole are two different things. I got to share this with you from the book here. It says, Debbie's murderer would be eligible for parole from Ironwood State Prison in 2017. The defense's sentencing memorandum had labeled Scott Fizell's crimes as a one-time bout of sexual rage, supporting the assertion that, in part through his claim of partial amnesia, he could not remember sexually defiling Debbie's body. Now that the plea was in place and sentencing was over, Fizell stated that he could, in fact, remember that part of his crime. Geez, that's convenient. But that Debbie was already dead. You know, this Debbie's law needs to pass. I got to admit, the research that I've done, I'm shocked that in 2010 that there are some states that it's not a crime to do what this character did, and he should spend the rest of his life and not have a chance for parole. That's for sure. I'm Dana Pretzer. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with a live interview with Clint Van Zandt. You know Clint as a regular on the show, a retired FBI agent, hostage negotiator, analyst, safety expert. His webpage, livesecure.org. We're going to talk about the Horman case, Kyron Horman, and we're going to talk about some of these cases. Have you heard of these where the young girls are getting acid thrown in their face? And in fact, did one of the victims actually do it herself, do it to herself? It's bizarre to say the least. You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. Clint Van Zandt, you'll know, is a semi-regular guest on the program, a former FBI agent, hostage negotiator, crime analyst, security expert, author. His webpage, livesecure.org, is the quintessential place for all your security tips and information, including the excellent telephone free app, Silent Bodyguard. Clint is here tonight to talk about some high-profile cases in the news, and it's always a pleasure to have Clint. Hi, Clint.
Hey, Dana. Good evening.
Now, before we get started with these terrible acid assaults,
yeah.
I want to get your thoughts on Kyron Horman. I know you've done a lot of media about this. You and I have talked about it many times. Here's a case that just seems to be kind of stuck in neutral, or am I wrong?
Well, I think that is probably the public perception. I think, you know, you and I and your listeners who, you know, are familiar with criminal investigations realize that there's a police investigation that's ongoing, and there's also, you know, the separate and somewhat independent grand jury investigation. And, of course, grand jury has the ability to subpoena people in and basically compel them to testify. And I think that's going on, too. And I think the reality is that in this particular case, you know, it's just, well, you know, it's like in a JonBenet Ramsey case where whatever your belief in that case, whether you believe that the parents had anything to do with it or not, you know, I've always said the only thing worse perhaps than losing a child is being accused of having anything to do with the loss of that child's life. And I think we see, at least if we take that set of facts, we see the same thing with Terry Harmon, where she may well have been convicted in the court of public opinion already, the stepmother, as having something to do with the disappearance of her stepson. But until that's proven, until, you know, until we find a body, until we're able to establish what happened to that young man, I don't think there's any way to suggest she had something to do with it. But what the grand jury also has, of course, the ability to do is look at other charges. Most people realize that there were allegations that about 5 months prior to Kyron's disappearance that she allegedly attempted to hire a handyman to kill her husband, the biological father of Kyron Harmon. And were I the district attorney, I mean, I would pursue that allegation if I could prove it, if I could get an indictment. I would go after that, you know, almost equally as much as I would anything concerning Kyron Harmon, because, of course, that particular allegation with someone to testify that it actually took place is something you might be able to prove, although if you're a defense attorney, you're going to say, well, wait a minute, this came after the fact 5 months later. How do we believe that took place? And hopefully there's other supporting evidence. But the bottom line is, here we are months and months later, birthday celebrations have come and gone, school has started, and there is a empty chair, an empty place, yeah. And that belongs to Kyron Harmon. And I think most investigators would suggest that the statistical probability of him still being alive and being held in some secret basement, dungeon, cabin in the woods or something like that is the stuff that, you know, made-for-TV movies are made out of. But there are those that have looked at the Elizabeth Smart case and J.C. Dugard case and others like that who continue to cling. And, you know, if I were a parent or a grandparent, and as you and I, Dana, have been investigators, I mean, I don't consider a child dead until I see that casket closed. Otherwise, we're looking for a potentially live victim. But for law enforcement, of course, the question is now, where do you find that little boy needle in a haystack?
Yeah, exactly. And I guess it's the public's impatience with the system and seeing everything broadcast in the media, Clint, the way that it is, talked to death on some crime shows, covered in the blogs,
night after night,
speculated after night. Over and over and over again, and then the public and the family must be sitting back and saying, well, what's taking so long? And we can name a dozen different stories with that have similar sets of circumstances. Does that media coverage hurt the investigation?
Well, I think the investigators in this particular case, those city, county, state, and federal investigators who've been involved in this, have done a pretty good job of keeping a lid on it.
Yep.
Some people have suggested that perhaps information that has leaked out about this case has come from investigators through the biological parents who have then spun it to the media, perhaps in an attempt to put pressure on who at least the biological parents believe knows what happened to Kyron, in this case his stepmother, Terry Harmon. So should that be the route that was taken to apply pressure on her? You know, as an investigator, I think a case needs to be solved. And however that's done, if it's done legally within the law, my position, Dana, is you put as much pressure on a potential suspect as you have to, as long as it's something that you're doing legally. And, you're not doing anything that's a violation of that person's constitutional rights. I guess the reality is Kyron Harmon ought to have rights, too.
Yep.
And those are the rights that seem to be oppressed right now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Clint Van Zandt is here. Clint, the reason I brought you on tonight is to talk about these acid assaults. And you can read some articles that Clint has written on Newsvine by going to clintvanzandt.newsvine.com about these assaults and other cases going back some time now. In fact, one of the cases, there's some suggestion that this gal actually did it to herself. And I got to tell you, that's mind-boggling. But we've all seen people who make up reports and they've actually brought harm to themselves before. Let's talk about that phenomena.
Well, I guess, you know, as an FBI agent and profiler, have been involved in enough investigations over the years, we always knew that every investigation was a two-track investigation, by and large, unless you had the suspect, you know, dead cold to rights. That number one, you take what the victim says as the gospel, and you run with that information, and you try to find the unknown suspect, the alleged offender who's out there somewhere. Number two, you take a hard look at that victim's background. You take a hard look at the physical evidence and the witnesses, and you say, does this story really make sense, and could this be a false allegation? Now, you know, Dana, most people would say, my God, are you nuts, Van Zandt? Somebody's going to throw acid in their own face? How could you say something like that? Well, you know, I only have to look back in my career as a profiler in the behavioral science unit, and Dana, I saw so many false allegations. I saw kidnap victims who had taken a etched instrument. In this case, one victim was a woman, and she took a knife or a razor blade, and she cut her own breast to add some credibility to the fact that she had been kidnapped and tortured, and yet we eventually found out she had made it up. I remember a bank officer who had said she was kidnapped and carried out in the woods and assaulted and left tied up in duct tape, and we worked that for days, and it just didn't feel right. Well, we finally got down to it. We did a real good interview with the victim. She did it herself. Her boyfriend was an ex-police officer. She wanted him back, so she came up with a story that would get him back. And I remember another bank teller who was writing threatening notes to herself because she wanted to get moved to a branch closer to her home. So she wrote these notes in hopes that the bank would move her. And then, you know, most of us remember the case of Jennifer Wilbanks, the so-called runaway bride who faked her own kidnapping. And then back in 1987, there was a terrible case of Tarana Brawley, that young 15-year-old woman who claimed that she had been kidnapped, assaulted, raped, defiled by half a dozen white police officers and a white prosecutor, district attorney. That was the one that the Reverend Al Sharpton jumped in on and almost created a race riot in New York City, and eventually turned out the whole thing was fake. The whole thing had been made up. So I think history is full of cases of where people have faked their own sexual assault, their own kidnapping. But, you know, this takes it one level further, Dana. Again, when I've seen, supposed suicides where a woman, would shoot herself with a gun in the face, you have to stop and say, well, wait a minute, you know, this country spends, whatever it is, $50 billion a year on makeup. You know, if that's across the board, not trying to be a chauvinist, but most of my experience has suggested that if a woman's going to kill herself, number one, she usually doesn't use a firearm, and if she does, she doesn't shoot herself in the head or face. Now, I have a good friend of mine whose 21-year-old daughter shot herself to death with a shotgun, and she shot herself in the head. So, I mean, there are cases where that doesn't take place. But when you look across the board and you look at the so-called, well, in fact, it is the histrionic personality disorder, and as you know, you and your listeners know that. I mean, this is a DSM-4 personality disorder, where an individual is they've got this tremendous pattern of emotional involvement with themselves. They seek attention. They need approval. Should this be a woman? This is somebody who dresses seductively. They're trying to bring attention on themselves. They want to be the center of attention. Now, some people will say, well, is this the same type of person who would crash a White House party and try to get their picture taken with dignitaries? And the answer is maybe yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in our particular case, you have to take that distinct personality disorder, you have to take the victim's background, and then you have to take the so-called evidence. Now, Dana, real quickly, as you read my article, there's a number of reports here. Number one, there was a so far unsubstantiated report that the victim in the case in Vancouver, Washington, had allegedly claimed to a reporter that she had been the victim of a similar earlier attack by another woman in another state. Dana, acid attacks in this country, in America, are so rare. For one woman to say, I've been attacked twice, two different locations, by acid thrown in my face, but, you know, so far that's unsubstantiated, so we don't know where it came from. The assailant allegedly said, hey, pretty girl, do you want something to drink, as the victim was getting ready to go into a coffee shop. Well, you have to say to yourself, who would this person be who's lurking outside of a Starbucks, pacing the street back and forth with a handful of acid, waiting for the appropriate victim to come up? And if this person was walking up and down the street, why didn't somebody see her? Why didn't somebody recognize her? Reporters went out and allegedly found homeless people living in a park right across the street who said, we were looking at the Starbucks restaurant at the time this woman fell to the ground and started screaming. There was nobody else close to her at the time. She was by herself. We saw no one run from the scene. Police department has not been able to come up with any suspects. They don't have any surveillance tapes whatsoever. The victim apparently bought sunglasses 10 minutes before the attack and just so happened to have the glasses on. Even though it was dusk, she had the glasses on, which prevented the acid from going in her eyes, and yet she was still able to give a wonderful description of her assailant, where while she was wearing sunglasses at dusk, having acid thrown on her face, she was still able to describe the victim all the way down to three different ear piercings in one of the victim's ear. And Dana, what some bloggers have suggested is the coup de grace for this particular victim is that she was scheduled to be on Oprah this Thursday, and then backed out of it because allegedly Oprah was going to ask her some tough questions on this. Well, all of that doesn't mean anything when you have the face, you know, when you have this poor face that had acid thrown in it. But law enforcement does and has to continue to ask themselves, is this person a victim of some terrible, outrageous assault? Was it some druggie? Was it somebody under the influence of alcohol? Was it somebody with a mental disorder? Was it some terrible gang joining ritual where you had to go out and throw acid in somebody's face? Or was there something in this victim's background that said, I need attention, I need people to really minister to me, and this is the way I'm going to do it? I mean, Dana, you know, I'm here to say, I don't know the answers, but I know as an investigator, I would have to consider that possibility and eliminate that just at the same time we do this parallel investigation trying to find the alleged assailant, which, interestingly enough, if we have this person who meets this description who's lingering outside of a Starbucks in Vancouver, you would think that would be a local person that either the cops on the beat or people around would know, especially with these three distinctive ear piercings and the other physical characteristics. Dana, nobody has come forward to say, I know somebody who looks like that so far. And I just find it hard to believe that an assailant would travel interstate to attack a random victim.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, we all remember Susan Smith in 94. And what's the old saying, Clint? If it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, you know, you hope that the law enforcement will be able to solve the case. Whether she did it to herself, which, again, some people won't believe, or there is someone that actually attacked this girl, it is something. But I guess my last question to you is with cases like this, Susan Smith, obviously, and others, is it the culture today that we see that some people just want to eventually bring some attention to themselves? You know, let's look at the jackass shows that they have where people go out and hurt themselves on video. You know, it's hard to believe someone would throw acid in their face just to get attention, but stranger things have happened.
You know, it's like going on the Internet, people who post pictures of themselves and phraseology and sayings, and you realize that those pictures and whatever you post is going to be floating in cyberspace alongside old episodes of I Love Lucy forever. It's going to be there. And, I mean, you may as well take lipstick and put the scarlet letter S for stupid on your forehead if you do things like that. Now, should this woman, and again, I mean, you know, you're torn because part of you, Dana, you and I and your listeners, we say, that's terrible. Who in their right mind would throw acid and permanently injure themselves? It just makes no sense. And I think that's part of it. It makes no sense to us, but for those who commit acts of cutting and, injure themselves and murder their own children, when they do things like that, it makes perfect sense to them. Sometimes it's done because they're reaching out, they want attention, it's the look at me. And sometimes in a person's poor, challenged mind, it appears to be the only answer they have to their problem, and that's what they choose. A terrible answer, a wrong answer, but one at that second, unfortunately, that in many cases appeared right to that person.
Yeah, for sure. It's a head-scratcher, and I'm sure we'll learn more about it as the days go on. Clint Van Zandt, his webpage is livesecure.org. Make sure and pick up the free app for your iPhone Silent Bodyguard. Thanks, Clint.
Thank you, Dana. Good night.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Clint Van Zandt, FBI experts, and talking about these acid assaults on females. It's bizarre. I sat down earlier today with Lisa Wanya, the author of Unsolved Murders of Canada. Unsolved Murders of Canada, I should say that right. And also her new project on Canada's Most Wanted. She's an excellent author. And here's what Lisa had to say. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Prentzer. You'll remember my next guest, Lisa Wanya. Gee, I hope I said that right. She'll give me hell in a minute here if I didn't. The author of the very popular book, Unsolved Murders of Canada. We had Lisa on a while back, and she's got a new project out there, a new book, Canadian Con Artist, and she's always working on something else crime-related, and it's great to have her on the program. Hi, Lisa.
Hello.
Did I butcher the last name?
Oh, you got it close. It's Wanya.
Wanya.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, from Saskatchewan, it's hard to say that. So, you know,
I'll forgive you.
Yeah, we're both Canadian. We say A a lot, so that's that's the best we can do. Listen, Unsolved Murders of Canada. I can, you know, having you on the show a while back, it seems like Canada because we live in such an Americanized culture. We see all the cable news shows and we hear about all the American stories. In fact, I cover a majority of them here on even on my program. But the Canadian stories seem to kind of, unless it's Picton or something like that, because we don't cover them the same way here. I want you to tell the audience a little bit about Unsolved Murders of Canada, and then we'll get into your new projects.
Well, there were 8 major cases in that book, and then a small chapter at the end with some smaller cases that didn't have as much information available to me to sort of flesh them out into bigger stories, which kind of speaks a little bit to what you were saying about the amount of information that's out there for people to keep some of these stories alive. And that's primarily how I made the choices that I did make on the stories that made it into the book. One was what kind of information was available to me, whether it was through newspaper archives or through first-person accounts of that maybe a family member wrote about their experience, as well as a few individuals that may have been willing to talk to me about their stories. So, but it is true, it's hard sometimes, and it's also our country is so large, and news seems to be very regional, unless it's a huge story like Picton. So you often don't hear in Alberta what's happening in, you know, Quebec or Ontario, unless it's a really huge, sensationalized case.
Well, even the media itself, Mike McIntyre, who we both know is a regular guest on the program here, but, you know, besides his Crime and Punishment radio show, the little bit of stuff that I do and a few other locals, there's not a lot of media coverage. Like, we don't have a Canadian Nancy Grace or, you know, and some may say thank God for that, but those sorts of ways of covering stories, is that a good thing, Lisa, or is that is that a Canadian thing where we're more of a I'm going to get in trouble for saying this. We're more polite, and we don't like to gross out the folks that are out there, even though I'm sure there would be a huge appetite from Joe and Mary Sixpack out there to hear these kind of stories and to have them covered on a nightly basis.
Well, I guess speaking from some of the victims' family members that I spoke to, I think that they would agree that there's never enough coverage and never enough media attention to the cases of the unsolved murder in their family or the missing person in their family, because they still want answers and they haven't been able to get them. One of the stories that didn't make it into the book was actually a woman I know here in Wetaskiwin, and her son was discovered with a friend of his, and they had been murdered. She didn't even know much about what was going on, and it had already been, you know, many, many months into the investigation. All she knew was that, you know, they thought he was killed in one place and his body was moved to another, and that's it. And there was, like, nothing covered in the media regarding this double murder. So, and this was the mother, and I'm sure she would have been very, very accommodating to give out as much information as possible to the media and, you know, looking for as much information from the police, but there wasn't a lot there.
Yeah. And again, you're right, because I have those folks on my show all the time. They want to get the word out. And even in the States, there's the 5 or 6 very high-profile cases that are covered on a nightly basis, but there's 106 that where the folks are just crying to get some kind of coverage. So, because the people that hear the stories could be the ones that could help solve the case. Let's talk about your new project, Canadian Con Artists. I haven't seen the book, but just the title alone sounds interesting. All we got to do is think about, you know, Conrad Black.
Conrad Black, yes, and he's not in the book.
No.
There's just a little mention about him. But yeah, it was quite an eye-opener to write this particular project because it just is mind-boggling how easily people can be taken in. In retrospect, like when you look back or when you're an outsider looking in, you think, how can they fall for that? And yet, we all do. Mm-hmm. Everybody, they're educated people that fall for some of these stories, people that are in investments that fall for an investment scam. You know, so it's not uncommon. We as human beings like to be trusting, and if you don't go through life with some amount of trust, then it's a pretty dismal life. So usually until people have proven themselves, you know, in a negative light, you want to be trusting. And unfortunately, you cannot be. I would like to talk about one story from Smithers, B.C.
Yep, absolutely. I was just about to ask you about that. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, this was a personal story because I was there working at the newspaper at the time, and a fellow by the name of Brian Richards, he went under that title, had just come into the valley, and it's a very small little community, about 6,000 people, but it's north. There's one highway from Rupert to Prince George, and it is, you know, pretty isolated for the most part, so everyone knows everybody. And this guy came in saying he was a pastor with the Assemblies of God, and he was going to put on this radio station with our local radio, or radio show with the local radio station for Christian rock for kids to give them a good, healthy alternative. And he said all the right things and whatever. Anyways, my editor told me I had to cover this story to promote this fellow and, you know, let the community know what was happening. And when he walked into the newsroom, he put his hand out and he looked at me and he was like, he's got to be 6'2" or something. He had long curly hair. He was wearing dark sunglasses and wearing a very loose-fitted, you know, workout sweats and whatnot. And he grabbed my hand and he says, you know, I'm Brian Richards. I'm this minister from this Assemblies of God. And I just looked at him and without even thinking, my mouth opened and I said, and I'm Lisa Wyna, and I was married to one of you, and I don't trust you either.
Good for you.
And I was going through a sad divorce at the time, and my ex was a minister, and so I was very, you know, saddened by that situation. But I told my editor, this is not sour grapes. There's something wrong with this man. I know he's not right, and I talked to the other pastors in the area. They all had concerns about him. And after I moved to Wetaskiwin in January of 2000, a couple months later, here on W5 is a big expose about this fellow. And what he was actually doing was selling shares in a resort that he didn't even own. He was selling, you know, advertising for this radio program, which he never actually sometimes produced the advertising. And it just went on and on and on like that. And there were so many people taken by him. And good people, I knew the people, you know, good, caring, loving, trusting people believed in him and thought, you know, here's this real down-to-earth looking guy. And, you know, and here he's doing these wonderful things for God. And, and it's not always what it seems.
That's for sure.
Unfortunately.
What's the old saying? If it looks too good to be true, it probably is.
Yeah, well, you know, it's true. And yet, on the other hand, you know, he from an outsider's point of view, looking in, you kind of didn't really see how he could be getting any benefit from this. I mean, he was paying for his own radio show, he said. Of course, maybe not all of those bills were actually paid, and maybe his money he got from advertising, you know, went to line his pockets. I don't know about all of those fine details, but yeah, it was very sad. Very sad for this community. That was a very close little community, and people believed in him. And people argued against other people who criticized him, saying, you know, give him a break. Like, you know, he's done all this wonderful work. He's worked in prison ministry and all this stuff, and it was not so.
Well, that is so true, and we cover those that like love to take advantage of others on this program all the time. And in my other career, I try to help people that have been taken advantage by others, and it just makes you sick. Now, I understand you're working on another project, Lisa, something about Canada's Most Wanted, another fascinating topic.
Yes, I've just started working on that in the last few months, and it is proving to be quite a challenge as well, because again, there's not as much information in the public as you would maybe have in the States. I've noticed FBI Most Wanted files, you can often pull, you know, somebody that the FBI is looking for, and there's a lot of information, background or stories, or you know, you can usually get something on these people. It's a little harder with the Canadians. And of course, you know, you have to be really careful that you're not going to profile someone who turns out to be perhaps found to be innocent in the end of all of this. So it's been a bit of a challenge, but it's quite interesting as well. And I've kind of divided the book into historic stories, stories that the case is closed, so the people are behind bars, and stories where there is a few that are still out and still wanted. but who are more than likely perhaps deceased. Perhaps they've taken their own lives. It's not clear, but that's kind of the way it's turning out right now.
Nevertheless, fascinating. Lisa Wonya is the author of Unsolved Murders of Canada and Canadian con artist, and is working on a new book, Canada's Most Wanted. I'm going to give you the last word. I want to ask you, Lisa, your thoughts on Picton and the coverage from not only a Canadian citizen's perspective, but an author's perspective. This is a story that I don't think we'll hear the end of for a very long time up here.
No. When I was writing the missing persons book, I did cover a little bit about Picton. He was just going to trial at that point. There was a fair amount of information in the media about him, and you know, details about what he was allegedly accused of doing and at that time, allegedly. And there were actually already a couple of books out specifically on him. I find that every once in a while I go back to see where the story's at, and there are lapses sometimes in what I can find that's more recent. And there are questions that I have about, you know, what about these other people that were mentioned earlier on in the investigation that have seemed to have dropped out of the spotlight? Are they still persons of interest, or are they, you know, still people that the RCMP or the police are following? So, you know, I think we do get quite a lot about it, but then we don't sometimes. So I guess that's the way the media goes. You know, there might be something else that's vying for the attention at that moment, and then we go back.
You're absolutely right. It seems like there's more unanswered questions than those that are answered. Anyway, Lisa, I really appreciate your time. Again, her most recent book, Canadian Con Artists. Go out and buy it. I'm sure it'll be a great one. You're always welcome on the program, ma'am.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, and thank you for all your good work.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye. That's author Lisa Wonya. Gee, I can't pronounce that, and I'm sure she'll forgive me for that. Unsolved Murders of Canada, or Canadian Con Artists. Just go to Amazon and Google it, and you'll be intrigued for sure. There's lots of interesting stories even up here. I'm Dana Pritzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. And we are back, and hopefully you enjoyed the show. Our website is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. Of course, there you can pick up the show live, listen to past shows, daily commentaries, leave comments, do whatever you like, just as long as you enjoy what we're trying to do for you. That makes me happy. That's it. I will see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
Been listening to the Dana Pritzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.